We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm Jeff Bossert, sitting in for David Inge, and we're going to profile the Eastern Illinois Baseball League this morning. I'm joined by Fred Croner of the News Gazette. We'll discuss his book, Catching Up, the Official History of the Eastern Illinois Baseball League, as well as former player of the EI League and big league player Darren Fletcher. To give you a flavor of what you'll be hearing about in this hour, I recently profiled some fans at a Buckley Dutch Masters game last month. Before we get started with the questions and answers, we're going to hear from some audio at Shibe Field in Buckley. This is back on July 17th.
My name is Wes Hetke. I probably started the Dutch Masters back in 1960-61, somewhere in there. I've been to every game, maybe not every one, but many, many of them. This crew right here, this is the way Buckley is right here. It's just they back up to the fence with their pickup truck and they watch a ball game for a little of nothing, you know. $15 season ticket. Where can you beat that, you know? Pretty hard to beat.
My name is Jeff Teske, and I'm living Buckley, and we just, you know, it's just a nice family thing to come out to every Sunday afternoon and watch our team play, and, you know, got to be good friends with a lot of the guys on the team over the years, and we've just come out here every Sunday for years, so it's just it's kind of a tradition. We're celebrating our town's tradition.
You know how many years you've been doing it?
42, and okay. I remember chasing foul balls down for a dime or whatever they paid us way back in the day. Well, they do it now, too, but they give them a quarter.
Inflation.
Yep.
My name is Jane Burmaster, and I live in Pinfield, Illinois. I'm originally from Paxton, and I've been a Buckley fan for years because my mom and dad used to bring us to Buckley games when we were all little kids, so I come out for the enjoyment of the ball games and know a lot of the players and ring my cowbell.
You just heard from Buckley Dutch Masters fans Wes Hetke, Jeff Teske, who was also the treasurer of the Eastern Illinois League, and Jane Burmaster. They were part of the crowd for a July 17th game versus the Lexington Snipes that was played at Shibe Field in Buckley. Those are two of the seven teams currently in the Eastern Illinois League. I'm Jeff Bossert, sitting in for David Inge. You're listening to Focus, our morning talk program. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Our technical director this morning is Kyle Mabry. The Eastern Illinois League has been a regular weekend activity for players and many fans since the early 30s. Joining us today to discuss the Dutch Masters and other teams that make up the league is Fred Croner. He started writing about the EI League in 1975 for the Champaign-Urbana Courier. And since 1982, he's been a full-time sports writer for the News Gazette. He's also the league's current president. Fred's new book is entitled Catching Up, the Official History of the Eastern Illinois Baseball League. Fred Croner is the author of two other books, Brian Cardinal, Citizen Payne, as well as Are You Ready? About former Illini football and basketball PA announcer Jim Shepard. Welcome, Fred.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad you could come in. We're also joined by a former EI League player with the Royal Giants, Darren Fletcher. The Oakwood native played in several games with the EI League and University of Illinois before he played in over 1,200 major league games with four different teams in a 14-year career. His grandfather Glenn and his father Tom were also prominent players in the league and were both professional ball players as well. Darren, glad you could come in.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
We're going to talk about the EI League today. We'll welcome your calls at 333-9455 or outlying area 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I guess it was appropriate to have just happened to be attending the game that featured Lexington and Buckley because they tied for the season title, and then Lexington won the league tournament, correct?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, that was a big weekend because they had to play, you know, they played a Saturday-Sunday series. They had to play four games because some earlier games in the season had been rained out. And the way it worked out, I mean, Lexington had to win three of the four games in order to tie for the regular season title. And that's the way it worked out. And that got them the number one seed for the tournament. And they went from there.
And this was a really hot day. And they had to play 20-some-odd innings, right? Weren't they making up for a rainout? Plus the regularly scheduled game, and then I think like seven innings of a previous game.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how many, but you're right. Yeah, it was a lot of baseball that day. But, you know, Buckley, the nice thing about Buckley, I mean, they've got the covered grandstand there. And, you know, so for the fans, I mean, it's really pretty nice. You get some nice breeze in there and just able to sit and relax and watch some nice baseball.
I was told by a lot of fans, you know, I told a lot of fans in Buckley that I felt Brad. I mean, I grew up in Kankakee County, and I had only recently heard of the EI League in the last few years. Can we talk about first who developed this concept? I mean, your book talked about, I think the most fascinating chapter is just in the first few pages, documents that explain how three men around Champaign-Urbana organized this league around 1933.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, at that time, it was called the East Central Illinois League. And then when teams like Buckley, for example, was one of them that wanted to get in the league, they had to change the name. And that was why it became then the Eastern Illinois Baseball League. And that's where some of the confusion begins, because the first two or three years, it was strictly for teams in Champaign County. And then when it became the EI League, there was some question, you know, do you just start the history of the EI League when the name changed? Or a lot of those teams were ones that had played, you know, starting in about the summer of 1933. So for some of the things that, you know, that you can trace the league all the way back to the early 1930s. And it's just interesting. I think one of the main things is the fact that Buckley's had a team in the league all 75 years. I mean, that in itself is pretty phenomenal for me.
And but Buckley actually had organized teams late 1800s.
Oh, yes. And you know, I don't know if they necessarily had a name for their team until I think it was maybe around the late 1920s, early 1931s. And the story that I got was some of the players were in a local pharmacy, and the proprietor was there, and they were looking at some Dutch Master cigars and said, you know, why don't you guys become the Dutch Masters? And, you know, that was kind of how it got started, and it stuck.
And there was obviously a lot of work underway in other towns, because there were, what, 10 teams when they got started in 1936 when they had established as an Eastern Illinois League?
Yes, 10 teams. And in fact, you know, and I didn't really get into this in the book, but for a period of time throughout the late 30s and 1940s, there was a separate league called the EI Teenage League. And what that was, it was almost kind of like a feeder league. It was for the younger kids, because back then there wasn't American Legion baseball. So, you know, and a lot of the high school teams didn't necessarily have baseball. So this was something for the younger kids. You know, they weren't good enough yet to play with the adults. But they had an interest in baseball. And so there was an EI Teenage League that, as I did research for the book, I would find the standings and results from that. And it was a lot of the same communities, but not necessarily, but a lot of the same communities had teams in the EI Teenage League.
Darren Fletcher, what was your first experience with the EI League as far, I mean, attending a game or knowing that they existed?
Well, just like you had on the audio, I was one of these kids that would be at the ballpark at Harper Park and Royal, and I'd be one of the young kids chasing the foul balls, you know, enjoying a Sunday afternoon at Royal and trying to chase a few foul balls and get a quarter or two. And you know, I had family members playing. My grandfather played for Royal, and then at that time, my dad was probably finishing up. He finished up his professional career and still wanted to pitch some, so he was pitching for Royal. And then I had an uncle too, Ken Fletcher, that was a player, and he played on the team. And I was a bat boy, and I just really enjoyed, you know, back in the 70s. I grew up in the 70s, wasn't playing for Royal until the mid 80s, but you know, it was a great time, and it was a way that we really spent our weekends as a family, was out at the ballpark.
And you were playing right around when you were still in high school, correct? Or
right. Right
around that same time.
Right after my sophomore year, I guess, the summer going into my junior year, Dad decided to take me out to Royal and see if I could play. They needed a spot, you know, another catcher, and they put me on the roster. So I was 15 at the time. I was going to be 16 in October of that year. But, you know, it was, you know, a lot of older guys, a lot of guys that were still college-type players, and then some established veterans that had been playing in the league for a long time. So in a lot of ways, I was rather nervous to be able to go out and try to compete against these guys. It was a league that I always looked up to and revered, because that's what, you know, I always wanted to play baseball, and in fact to step on the field and try to play. So it was a fun time, and it was some of my most memorable some of my most memorable days as an amateur player was playing for Royal.
Welcome your calls or questions, or even if you had you have a story you want to relate about a favorite game in the rich history of the Eastern Illinois League, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Welcome your questions or comments for Fred Croner and Darren Fletcher this morning. What's the tryout process, or is somebody just become, you know, pretty good in high school and the coach is aware that you'll be able to fill in pretty well? And either of you can answer that question.
Well, I think the way it has kind of developed, I mean, at this point, some of the newer teams still have tryouts, but I think a lot of the veteran teams like Buckley, Gifford, Flatville, Royal, Paxton, teams like that, first of all, I mean, they get a nucleus of players that come back every year, and then the ones that aren't coming back, they kind of see what positions those are, and then they go out, you know, somebody from the, you know, whether it's one of the players or one of the coaches, to some of the area colleges to see, you know, who's doing pretty well, or in some cases the high school, because, I mean, I know this year the Paxton team had a number of players that played for the outstanding Paxton-Buckley-Loda High School team during the spring that came out and played for the Swedes this summer. So a lot of it, rather than maybe an actual tryout, is kind of more of a recruited thing. Or in a lot of cases, I mean, you get kids that come up, you know, their parents are, like Darren was saying, their father, their uncle played, and they've been there, and it kind of becomes a goal for them to get to the point where they're good enough to come out and compete in the summertime against these players.
We started talking a little bit about the history. The first business manager was Arlie Seymour back in the early 30s, and admission, well, it was 25 cents around that time. I mean, did they make much money then? I know that was a kind of a sore point, or a hard thing to do, was to charge admission to attend the games at first.
You know, I never, of course, got to know Arlie Seymour, but, you know, he must have been quite the entrepreneur, because besides baseball, I mean, he did a lot of other things to get people to come out to the games, where it was, you know, parachute jumping, sheep races, you know, just all kinds of contests and things to get people out there. So it wasn't just an afternoon of baseball. I mean, the baseball maybe was the highlight, but he did a lot of things. And, you know, I think that's to his credit. The story was he was passing through Buckley, him and his wife. They wanted to get a place to eat, or they wanted to get a bite to eat, and they couldn't find a place to eat. And he said, this town needs a restaurant. So he decided to just move to Buckley, and he started a restaurant, and then it just kind of developed from there. I mean, he went out, the baseball team was playing one day, and he went out and watched, and he said, where's your gatekeeper? And he couldn't believe they didn't have somebody charging and taking admission, and that was just kind of how he got involved. They said, well, you know, you can become our business manager, and you can just kind of, you know, take over. And that was kind of what happened.
The parachute jumps, et cetera, they make me feel a lot like they seem a lot like what you would see in a minor league game today. Similar promotional events tied to, you know, those professional games and things that entice families into attending games.
Well, and I think that's a good thing, because, I mean, you know, the more different activities and things you have, you're going to appeal to a wider variety of people. And then in some cases, you know, the people that maybe weren't there for the baseball might stick around and watch and decide, hey, you know, this is kind of interesting. You know, maybe they know somebody, maybe their neighbor's playing or a relative, and they decide this is kind of interesting, and they come back again. And then, like a lot of these people, I mean, I think Wes Hethke hit the nail on the head when he said he'd been around since the early 1960s. I mean, you know, 50 years, I bet he's missed very few games in that time. It just kind of becomes a part of you. It's during the summer. It's something you look forward to and really, really want to do.
Now it's, what, a couple of bucks, something like that?
Yeah, I think $2-3 for the most part. I mean, there's even a few that don't even charge admission. But, you know, it's, you know, for what you get a 9-inning first game, a 7-inning second game, and you get a lot of good players that, you know, have really put a lot of time and sweat into getting to this point where they can remain competitive, and they really are very competitive.
How much of the team's fundraising relies on that, and then how much is going to be like some donations and your raffles and other fundraisers?
Well, I think any more. I mean, when you're starting a team, you have to invest a lot more than once you've got a team going. I mean, for example, once you've had the team going and you've got the uniforms, you know, you don't have that charge from year to year. But I know in the case of Urbana, which rejoined the league a few years ago, they had to come up with the uniforms, and then, of course, you know, the home team pays for the umpires. But I think at this point, a lot of the fundraising does happen in the off season, whether it's a 50-50 raffle or a big get together or whatever it is that they do. A lot of the money has to come from those off season contributions and fundraisers.
At least 9 different major leaguers, including my guest today, Darren, have played in the Eastern Illinois League at some time. Darren, if we could talk a bit about the talent involved and how much did that experience on the weekends and with the Royal team help you as a catapult? You also played at the U of I and then help start that career and bring you on up to that skill level.
Well, I guess for me. I think it was kind of a litmus test on where I was at as a young player. I mean, at 20, when I was 21, 22 years old, I mean, I was already playing professional baseball, but I think my dad wanted to see, where I was at 15, 16, and 17. Was I good enough at that age to be able to compete at really the highest level at the amateur level that's around here, and EI baseball was still, still a very competitive league. And I think, just wanted to find out how good I was. Could I hang with the adults and playing with the league? So, it gave me a boost of confidence, I guess, is the fact that I was performing pretty well at the EI league level. And, I remember Tom Deaton, the coach at the University of Illinois, when I was being recruited to play at different schools, Tom would come out and see me play at EI. So it was a good way for college coaches also to judge talent that was wanting to go on to play college baseball, because they could see that, hey, if a teenage kid can compete with these guys, that they may have a chance of playing well at the collegiate level.
And we have a lot of other names attached to the league, I mean, that have remembered from the big leagues: Kevin Seitzer, Dick Hyde, Matt Hurgis, Scott Geraltz. Is that the proper pronunciation?
Geraltz.
Well, a lot of people, major league announcers said Geraltz or Geraltz. I think it depended on where he came from.
Right.
I didn't want to upset any listeners in Buckley. And Mark Carlson, a big league umpire, and John Felsky, who managed the Phillies in the 80s. They all played in the EI League. So I have to ask, with all these names attached and the rich history, could we one day see a museum or something other than outside of your book and a lot of writings in different communities that would honor this history?
I don't know. I mean, there would have to be a lot that would go into something like that. I mean, locating a building, getting the memorabilia, and so on and so forth. But it's an interesting concept. I think, one of the reasons I was anxious to do the book was to get down, on paper, a lot of the stories, a lot of the records, a lot of the history and tradition that I was afraid would just be lost if it weren't. So, I mean, in a way, the book is kind of, serves that kind of purpose. I mean, okay, it doesn't have the trophies from 1940 that you can reach out and touch, but it tells a lot of the history and a lot of the tradition, and I think that was something that was important, at least for me, to try to preserve that so that, future generations can look back and, see what an accomplishment it was for these people to – I mean, when you talk about somebody like – look at Kevin Sproul, for example, the all-time pitching leader, won 125 games. And you might say, well, that doesn't sound a lot. Cy Young won over 300. But you're talking about somebody that's pitching basically on a Sunday to Sunday. Occasionally there was a midweek game. So to get to 300 wins, I mean, I think Kevin probably played for 18, 19, 20 years. And to get to that many wins is just pretty phenomenal. And Jeff Demuth with the hits record, 461 hits. Maybe now you say, well, major leaguers get 200 hits, 200 plus in a season. But again, I mean, when you're getting, maybe 7 or 8 at-bats a week is all you're getting, to be able to put up those kind of numbers over a career is just absolutely astronomical.
Welcome your calls and comments on the Eastern Illinois League, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We went through some of the names. I like lots of the stories you have are attached to players. Flatville's player, M. Franzen?
Excuse me.
He turned down a professional contract because he was making more in the 40s in his excavation and construction business. So that's just a big indication how times have changed. A guy that I think that was the Dodgers? I can't remember who was trying to sign him.
I think it might have been.
Mm-hmm. But And a lot of things, too, not only people that had professional aspirations or a chance at that, but maybe we could talk about the ties to the community that these teams have had. I mean, so many of them have that friendships have come about from because guys got to know each other on the team, and then they and relationships started by friends just getting together to watch the games.
Well, and I think, you know, another thing you see, too, is, and I know Paxson has done this and Buckley has done this in recent years, they try to develop that hometown pride, that hometown player, because what that does then on a week-to-week basis, it encourages more fans to come out when they, you know some of the people. You know, maybe they had grown up watching these players play in the, you know, from little leagues all the way through high school, as opposed to, you know, it's nice to get these other players that come in, you know, that have played in college, but maybe there's not that necessarily that identification. And I think in recent years, I believe in 2009, Paxton had something like 80 to 85% of their players were either from their community or just, you know, shortly, you know, in the Milford, in the Fairbury area, just very, very close. And again, I think what that does, that helps promote some interest, you know, in the players that are playing on those teams.
We have a caller on line one in Champaign. Go ahead.
Well, good morning, Jeff. This is Mike Sola. Fred, it's good to hear from you again. And Darren, I never met you, but I've watched your career. I wanted to call because I sort of played in the EI League 1 year, 1982, with Buckley Dutch Masters. I sported number 7, Mickey Mantle's number, but I was a bullpen catcher, and they had a speed-up rule. So if the catcher got on base, you could put in a pinch runner. And Virgil Shivey decided to put me in for Will Weinhorst, and I immediately stole second base. And then I took off, and I stole third, slid past the bag, got tagged out just square right in the middle of my face, crawling back to the bag. So I got up and ran across the field, dusting my face off, and Virgil just shook his head, and he said, "Son, I'm going to have to put a leash on you." And Billy Wantland was standing right there, and he sort of chuckled and said, "Yeah, we'll put a leash on that sprinting dog." And that became my nickname for my 1 year at Buckley, and then a few years later, I went back to see because I, you know, you develop friendships in the dugout, and especially when you're in the dugout as much as I was. Went back for an old-timers game, and not intending to play, just to watch. And I caught for both teams for about 4.5 innings. It's where I first met Ernie Westfield, and so I got more innings in the field during the old-timers game than I did during my career. But that 1 year at Buckley just has provided me with plenty of memories, and one of them indeed, Wes Hedke standing there yelling for the team the whole game. So just wanted to call and say, Fred, I appreciate your work on the EI League, and I'll be listening.
You know what? That's a good story. I wish I'd known about that sooner. That would have been a nice little tidbit to have had in the book.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, maybe in the addendum.
There you go.
There you go. In the sequel to this book.
Darren, I did want to ask, were there a few players, and one of them that I didn't play much and never got to the level you did, but, you know, playing against Billy Elliott, and again, when I played the season, I got, I think, 2 or 3 at-bats during the year, and he threw a fastball, strike 2, and then a curveball that buckled my knees, and I walked back to the dugout saying, "That was the best curveball I've seen all year," and, you know, 2 at-bats. But some of the players that were in the EI League on a long-term basis, you think they could have played in the majors if they would have had just a little bit more? I don't know what they would have needed more of, because they showed plenty of it on the field.
Well, I mean, there has been players that have made it to the major leagues that has played in the EI. And you know, those guys that like the Bill Elliotts and the Kevin Sproul, I mean, they were very good players. I think all of them, I'm not sure, but a couple of them, I think, has got some minor league experience. Wasn't Bill Elliott in professional baseball, Fred?
Cincinnati Reds organization, yeah, actually as a pitcher, though.
Right. I remember him as a hitter. I remember Bill Elliott as the guy that hit home runs. Right.
Yeah.
And was Kevin Sproul, did he ever have any professional time?
He had a tryout with the Cardinals, but I think
right.
That was about as far as it went.
Right. Well, I mean, these guys were on the borderline of being professional players. I mean, to be in the big leagues, I mean, you got to work your way up and, you know, weave your way through a lot of different levels to make your way to the top. But a lot of these guys were very close to being professional caliber ball players.
Well, I played with Mark Shivey too, and you know, he was another one who had it just seemed all the skills, but, you know, just maybe the breaks didn't go right. And I think he went to the minors and suffered an injury trying to catch up to some of the guys who'd been playing winter ball. And, I'm going to hang up and listen, but just wanted to say I'm enjoying the conversation.
All right, thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. The familiar voice, WILL listeners, Mike Sola. Mark Scheibe, another name that someone else I talked to during that game in Buckley that day. And, yeah, he tried out for had been drafted by the Cubs and was part of a really good team at Buckley, a high school team out of 79, drafted with Scott Durelts. And but I understand rotator cuff or something like that ruined his career after A-ball with the Cubs.
Now, how impressive is that Giralt and Mark Scheibe were in the same high school graduating class at Buckley Lota, which probably had, I don't know exactly, but I'm sure fewer than 100 students, probably 90 students in the whole high school and probably maybe about 30 in the graduating class, and then two of those guys are drafted in the Major League draft.
And from what I understand, you even made a mention of in your book is that Mark, you know, didn't make it as a pitcher because of injuries, but then came back to play into his 40s in the EI League and was, as Mike had mentioned on the call, hit a lot of home runs and probably had he been maybe drafted at a different time, I mean, the timing just wasn't right, he could have made it I think he was at first base when he came back.
Yeah, you know, a lot of that is just the breaks and, you know, where you're at, who else is on the team, you know, are you hurt, are you at full strength, and you know, I've heard a number of people say that, in particular about Mark Scheibe, that, you know, in a different situation, a different time, without the injuries, that he might have had a career, you know, similar to what Scott Giraltz did. Of course, Giraltz was up with the Giants for a number of years and just had an outstanding Major League career.
The other name that was brought up was Ernie Westfield. He certainly has local celebrity status. He's on the cover of your book, and I think he's, 70, 71 years old, and from my understanding, he can still throw fairly hard and pitched in the Negro Leagues at the end of their when the majority of African American players had major league talent were in the majors by the late 50s, I believe.
And I think that was kind of what had gotten him here. Wardell Jackson, who had a team in Champaign, had a couple teams in Champaign at different times, had seen him play, or maybe he even played against a team that Wardell was coaching back when Ernie was in Tennessee. And that was what got him up here and a couple other players. And then once up here, for a number of years, I think from, I don't know, 61 or something, for, you know, up until about the early 70s, mid-70s, played quite a bit in the EI League and on some very good teams with the Champaign Eagles primarily.
Let's talk about, the different cities involved. We mentioned Champaign Eagles and Urbana has a team. And what is, what has been the big contributing factor? Is it money that keeps a lot of teams? They may have a team just for a few years, and you, as I mentioned at the start of the show, 51 different communities at one time or another have had a team, but some have not been able to sustain that for very long.
I think part of what it is maybe you get a nucleus of players that kind of grow up playing together, from the little league through high school, maybe in college, and then they want to continue playing together, in their early adulthood. And so I think that's why some of these towns will have teams that will just kind of thrive for a while, and then as those guys get a little bit older, you know, maybe the team will fold up.
With the parks that they, or the diamonds they play on too, I walked on to Scheibe Field and it felt like I was in Field of Dreams. I felt like, you know, I was in, you know, Kevin Costner's field, and because it's really well maintained. It well mowed and you have a manual scoreboard out there. You also have a nice crowd. I've been told Sundays there's been several hundred people up there with their or in the seats back of their pickup trucks, whatever. But is it a lot of just fundraising that is allowed and volunteers that allow these fields to stay pristine throughout the season?
Well, you know, a lot of it is, you know, and especially at Buckley. And by the way, you know, I should mention, I mean, you know, a lot of times people don't necessarily know what kind of fields you're talking about. Buckley, I think it's 415 feet to straightaway center field. So, I mean, you know, if you hit a home run up there, that's a legitimate home run. It's not like it's, a softball type fence where, you know, you just get the ball in the air, it's going to carry and go out. So, I mean, that's the first thing right there is, like you say, it's just a very outstanding field to begin with. And I think a lot of the people that are involved in the maintenance, well, first of all, it takes more than one person. I think if one person had to do that all the time, you know, they're going to burn out. But I think they have a lot of help from the Legion up there. I think there's a lot of people such as Mark Shivey, who, you know, his dad, Virgil Shivey, was a great player. And then he coached for the team. And then kind of in his later years, he took over some of the operation and maintenance of the field. And Mark does that. And there's a crew of people. I mean, I would hate to start listing everybody because there's just so many involved. But I think that's what enables some of these fields to just be so outstanding is because of the commitment that the people make and that there are a number of people that are willing to do it. So there's not the pressure on one person to feel like, you know, they have to go out there every Saturday afternoon and get the field mowed and you know, get it, you know, watered and playable for the next day because there's a lot of help.
We talked a little bit. I want to point out, too, that some of this, the sights and sounds of Buckley and Shivey Field will be part of a program, a short segment on WILL TV later next month, airing along with 10th Inning, the Ken Burns baseball program, September 27th and 28th. Talking about the Buckley Dutch Masters. I mean, we're talking about the team that has been there the longest and stayed at the longest. This is the second field that they have had, and Virgil, and that's why it, and the name is Shivey Field, named for Virgil Shivey.
At least the second field. I there might have been another field in there. Some of the early years and some of the facts and figures from those early years, I'm not real clear on. I know that there was a field. They said at Charlie Martin's or behind Charlie Martin's, who was there in Buckley. And I think it might have even been in the same vicinity, or at least one of the fields might have been. But it's at least the second field that they have had. And like I say, it's just a very well-maintained and kept up field.
How was it for you to get all these? We did the interview for TV. We talked a little bit about how you were able to compile all these facts and figures and newspaper articles and photos, and how challenging was that?
Well, I'll tell you what, the hardest part was, you know, people have asked me, how long did it take to write the book? Well, the funny thing is the writing did not take that long. It was all the research that took all the time. There were some things that I had a lot of information for, like I had the list of batting leaders, I had a list of home run leaders, but those lists just included the person, the last name, the team that he played for, and the particular statistic, and I was bound and determined that anybody that got mentioned in the book was going to have a first name to go along with the last name. And I'll tell you, I mean, the very last first name that I had to track down took about 3.5 hours at the library. And the year it was a home run leader from the late 1940s. And what I had to do, I had to just start when the season started. In that year, I think it was in late April. And I just had to go through day by day by day to see when there was a story in and look for this person's name. And I think it was about the third week of August before I finally found that person's name. So, you know, things like that just were really time consuming. And took a lot of time, but the actual writing, once I got to that, I think things just fell into place pretty quickly.
Darren, do you have a favorite team or favorite year, either as a player or as a kid watching there, that thought, boy, these guys were, you know, really gelled and
Well, it was Royal. I mean, I played with Royal, and my family had always played with the Royal Giants, so that's the team that I followed.
Is there one year that was?
There was several years that they had competed well and went deep into the playoffs. As a boy, I got a kick watching my dad play and then my uncle. It was fun. You know, the flavor of the league was it was Sunday afternoon. The country boys would, you know, back their trucks up on the field, and you know there was a barbecue going, fish fry, and there was plenty of beer being drunk. You know, that's how the league was. It was really kind of a party type atmosphere at Royal at Harper Park when we played. It was just a fun thing to do, and I miss it. Those were fun times when I was a young kid, and it's too bad that particular field is not there anymore either. That Harper Park, they ended up turning back into farm ground, but a lot of good memories. And you bring some of those older guys from Royal, and you have them here on the radio station. They could pull up and recall plenty of cool stories that has happened there. And there's just a lot of history, and you know, I'm from Oakwood. I grew up north of Oakwood, but I still have, our family has a connection with Royal, and we feel like it's really our second home.
welcome your calls and questions on the Eastern Illinois League on 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Fred, one of the first stories you brought up was that someone I think had gotten married, but that had agreed to pitch to postpone his honeymoon by a day. He was needed on that weekend.
Well, you know, there were several stories like that over the years, and I think in that particular case, he had gotten married the Saturday before the tournament championship game, and so therefore, you know, he wasn't going to miss, or his teammates didn't want him to miss the championship game of the tournament. But then as the story goes, I think a limousine pulled up in about the sixth or seventh inning, and he had to leave the game a little bit early, but at least he had gotten to play in quite a bit of the game.
One thing that seems to be a hardship in maintaining his team is not actually having your own field. I mean, some teams does the Urbana team, I think they play in Rantoul right now? Or where are they?
Well, Urbana, when they came back into the league last year in 2009, they were a traveling team the entire year. This year, they had one doubleheader at Prairie Park in Urbana and one up in Rantoul, and I think they are looking to try to be able to get a field full-time next year. I mean, one of the problems is there are not a lot of fields in Champaign-Urbana, and the ones that there are being used by, the Legion or the Junior Legion, and so trying to, coordinate the EI schedule along with that makes it a little bit difficult, which, there was a time in the mid-'80s when Danville had an EI team, and they played at Danville Stadium, which is just, a fabulous facility over there. But again, I mean, trying to coordinate, everything over there. Danville has had a college league team for a number of years now. It used to be the CICL League. Now it's the Prospect League. And there's just so many games that, that a field can take and so many dates that the field is available. And finally, I think by the time that the Danville Roosters were done, close to being done in the EI League, one of the big factors was just it was so difficult to be able to get a field.
And there are other how does this compare to other amateur leagues? I mean, I assume do we have some sort of organization that follows all of them? Because there's also a Central Illinois League, I believe, because Lexington had played in that league before they joined the Eastern Illinois League.
They had. There are different areas. I know Peoria has a league. I think it's called the Sunday Morning League that they have over there. There's a league in Springfield. Bloomington Normal had for years what was called the Corn Valley League, and I think it did not go quite back as far, as 1936 when the EI started, but I believe it had a number of years in the league, probably more than 50 altogether, and then it just kind of eventually ran out of steam and I believe is no more. Which is one of the reasons why Lexington wanted to get into the EI League. You know, one of the reasons I believe that Lexington has been so successful the past few years is that they schedule beyond the EI League. The EI is basically a Sunday-to-Sunday league. You know, there might be a Saturday doubleheader if somebody has to make something up later in the season. But Lexington is able to get a number of college players that they would not be happy just playing two games a week on Sunday. So the management over there at Lexington, they get a number of midweek games. I mean, they may play two or three nights a week, going to Springfield, the Chicago suburb, Peoria, wherever they need to go. And a lot of those players, by the time they get into the EI tournament, they have played 45 to 50 summer games, which makes a huge difference. Then when you're talking about an EI team, I think this year during the EI regular season, there are 18 regular season games. And so when you've played more than twice that number of games by the time you get to the tournament, it's a huge factor in your favor.
And there's still lights in Buckley. I don't know how many stadiums had been equipped for night games. Is that a thing of the past?
I think so. In fact, I'm not sure that I don't think the lights are usable. They're still there, but I don't know that they can really be used. But, in fact, one of the stories in the book was how the Buckley got the lights. And again, it goes back to Arlie Seymour from when there were lights at the Chicago World's Fair. And he made arrangements to get the lights down there into Buckley and get them installed and used. And I saw some of the posters and billboards from some of the early years. And that was one of their advertising things. Come see night baseball in Central Illinois. And at the time, other than like a minor league field, it was one of the few, if maybe the only, field around the area that could have a night baseball game. So that was one of the selling points early in Buckley's existence as well.
Another familiar name attached to the league, Lauren Tate, known well for many, many years, writing about sports, the U of I, and in this area for the News Gazette. And I think he he played up until he was about to start work for the paper just a couple days later.
Lauren Tate and Roy Rademacher are the, at this point through 75 years, are the only people that have won batting championships and pitching championships in the same year. And I believe Lauren's was in around 1957 and Roy Rademacher a few years after that, the early 60s. And that's just a remarkable feat in itself to be able to lead the league as far as pitching and hitting in the same season. But, I never had a chance to see Lauren play baseball. I've seen him play some softball over the years, and I believe he's still very competitive there. But from what people tell me, I mean, he was just a very good competitor. And, you know, there's a section about him in the book, and I think one of the things I find interesting is that he wasn't necessarily the outstanding player throughout high school and even at the University of Illinois. He admitted that, you know, he probably rode the bench more than a lot of people, which kind of fueled his desire. I mean, you know, maybe if he had been somebody that, was this outstanding player in high school and college, he would have found other things to do in the summer or just wouldn't have wanted to have been involved. But because of that background, it fueled his fire and it just really prompted him to stick with it and work and improve, and the results spoke for themselves.
Got just over 10 minutes left. If you'd like to throw in a question or comment about the Eastern Illinois League, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I got to ask, Darren, your son hit what? So something over, like, just over 500 for Oakwood this past season?
Right, at the high school.
What are the chances we might see
him with Royal?
Him with Royal or him, you know, have higher aspirations and have maybe the kind of career you had?
Maybe I'll come out of retirement and Casey and I can play for Royal for 1 year. I don't know. I'd probably blow out something. But, he's playing in American Legion baseball. And, you know, nowadays, once you commit with one particular team, they kind of frown upon you playing for other teams. So when I played, though, I played for Royal on Sundays, but I played for the Post-210 Danville Legion on, you know, through the week, and now and again I'd pick up a game during the Twilight League, too, that was in Danville. So I had three different uniforms in my closet when I was a teenager, and, you know, that was the arrangement that I had with the Legion team in Danville, is that I was going to play on Sundays for Royal. Nowadays, I don't know if that's possible, but, hey, it'd be kind of neat if they'd played. It'd be kind of neat if Royal had their own field, too. You know, they're sharing the field with Gifford, which is a very fine field. But, I don't know what they're going to do. Royal, you know, have their fundraisers, and they're going to always be in the league. I think they're looking for a new coach. But, yeah, it's a wood bat league, too. And I think that's something that's probably, has the feedback been pretty positive, Fred, with being a wood bat league as opposed to an aluminum bat?
It has. That's something that probably developed early this decade, maybe around 2002, 2003, somewhere in that neighborhood. And it was kind of an experimental thing. But you're right. I mean, the feedback has been very positive, and I don't see it changing anytime soon now.
Yeah, that's something that, you know, with wood bat, it's a little purer. And I think that's a selling point for that type of league, is that it kind of, you know, reminds you of years past and having the wood bat. You know, I always played when I was an aluminum bat, but the only thing is with players, sometimes high school players, they'd rather play on leagues where they can use the aluminum bat, where you get a little bit more jump off of it. And but that also adds to a little bit more of the cost too, doesn't it, Fred, of the league, because those wooden bats are not cheap, and you probably go through quite a few of them during the season.
Yeah, you know, that would be interesting for me to track down. I don't know the exact number of how many bats, but I know the games I saw this year, I bet each week I saw at least one broken bat, if not more. I mean, sometimes there would be two or three during the course of the game. So I'm sure over the course of a season, 18 or 20 games, the teams are going through quite a few bats.
Darren, has, with your major league career, had you had teammates with the four teams you were on that had similar, any kind of experience like this in a regional type summer weekend thing that, you know?
I would think so. I mean, I can't remember everything, but, you know, everyone's got a little story of where they came through at the amateur level. And, you know, there's a lot of these leagues all across the country. And, but it's neat that we had one, and we had such a rich history with our little towns, playing baseball. And, I just can't remember. Did you do any research on that, Fred, as far as you know, does it seem like that, you know, every little, lot of little towns probably in Indiana and Ohio and across the Midwest that had these little teams? Because it was a different area, in my opinion, and talking to him with my grandfather, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, that's what you did. There wasn't that. What you did for entertainment is that you went out and watched your local boys play sports or watch them play baseball. It wasn't you know, running to the movies or watching TV. The small town revolved around your town's baseball team in the summertime.
And you know, one of the interesting things I noted as I was doing research and going through the microfilm at the News Gazette is a lot of the game recaps in the Monday paper, they would talk about the crowd. And I mean, there would traditionally be 1,500, 1,900 people at, you know, the featured game from the day before. So I think, you know, that speaks exactly what you're saying. I mean, that was the activity. Sunday morning, people would go to church. Sunday afternoon, they would go to the EI baseball game. And, you know, for years and years, the history of the EI League was one 9-inning game. And I think they started it at either 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So, I mean, it gave people time to get home from church, to have a little lunch, and then get out to the game. And then that was the activity. And then they would stay afterwards and usually cook out or, you know, give the kids a chance to run around on the field. But, you know, that was the thing that I noticed consistently week after week is just the size of the crowds that, you know, used to be documented in the game stories.
Got just a few minutes left. If you want to get in a call, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. I just look at the way Casey, the way your son played last year. I wonder if we may have four generations of Fletchers possibly in professional baseball, because I don't know. There's a few stories like that in the majors, but
right.
Three maybe. I mean, I don't know about four.
Right. It'd be neat, wouldn't it? But that's a tough one to put on a kid. Let's see if we can get him through his senior year, you know. But it could be that would be an easy one to do, to be able to have four generations play for the Royal Giants.
Yeah.
Because his great-grandfather Glenn played and grandfather Tom and then me, of course. But, yeah, there's just a lot of neat history in this league. And I wish Fred the best, being the president of the league and know a lot of the coaches that are in the league. And I hope that it continues to survive and grow and never go away. I think that's always your fear, is that with all the different things that are out there that pull the good players away from the league, that you can continue to get quality players and attract fans to come watch the ball games.
Well, you know, that's one of my concerns, too, because, I mean, there have been a number of different stories. I think one of the best ones is Thomas Burrow from about 7 or 8 years ago wound up getting out of the league. And, you know, you know, of all the reasons to get out, you might say, well, okay, they don't have any money. Well, they had money in the bank. You say, well, they don't have enough people who want to play. They had people who want to play, but they were not able to get somebody in the position of, you know, doing the day-to-day stuff, doing the managing on Sundays, you know, organizing the rosters and stuff like that. And so eventually the team just went under. And you know, that is one of my fears, and one of the things that I want to try to fight against is, you know, to see that happen on a league-wide basis. Because I think a league that has been around as long as the EI and has the tradition that it does, I would like to see it continue indefinitely.
What else? You just kind of over. What do you do in your role as president? I guess on a regular basis, just kind of monitor how teams are going.
Yeah, I mean, realistically, it's not that difficult. I mean, organize some meetings about 4 or 5 times a year. Just try to keep everybody on the same page. You know, occasionally there are some complaints or protests that happen during the season that you know, we have to check with the other commissioners and make a ruling on. And then beyond that, I mean, just, you know, to make sure that, you know, the various deadlines are met by the managers in terms of turning in rosters and so on and so forth, and just kind of, you know, overseeing everything, really.
Have they had a tournament the whole time at the end of the season?
Yes, there's always been a tournament, at least as far as I know. There might have been 1 or 2 years in there that did not exist, but I think for the most part there's always been a season-ending tournament.
It's nice because I look at it, I mean, teams can not win a single game or really struggle, and I kind of compare it to, like, you know, if Illinois struggles and then they, basketball, and then they have the Big Ten tournament, they can totally turn things around. And you've had some stories like that where a team catches fire in that weekend.
Well, in fact, yeah, there was one story. In fact, it's happened one time. A team that was last place in the regular season wound up winning the tournament. So, sure, I mean, it's just kind of like a new life, a new chance, and you never know what has happened during the season. You know, maybe some of your players were injured or out of town, and, you know, maybe the conversely, some of the players from the other team, all of a sudden tournament time, they're no longer available. So it really can be, a new beginning for teams.
Are there any other cities that are on the cusp of perhaps forming a team or some that have come to you and expressed interest?
Well, you always hear different things, and you know, until it actually happens, you don't know. I mean, I had heard there's some interest up around the Colfax area, which, is kind of between Lexington and Buckley. There might be interest there. At different times, people have talked about, a team again in Danville. But like I mentioned earlier, I'm not exactly sure where they would play, where they would be able to go to. And then a couple of years ago, we had a team in Effingham that had to get out basically because of like I said, with the Thomasboro case, it was a management type thing. But I've heard that there might be some interest in people down there that they still want to play and come back. So I think there's interest, but the bottom line is, are they going to make the commitment? Because it is a long season. I mean, it starts in mid-May and goes until August, and you're committing. If you have an even number of teams, you're committing every Sunday. Now, this year with an odd number of teams, there'd be a Sunday off for everybody, and, that's kind of a mixed blessing. I mean, maybe some of the players like to have it off, but I think in terms of organizing a league, it's certainly a lot easier and things go smoother when you have an even number of teams.
I want to pass along a reminder, a couple of things. We're looking for your Central Illinois baseball stories. If you have a favorite moment or game or player concerning teams in this area, not just the EI League, but Little League, High School, minor league teams, because they've had minor leagues in Danville a while back. And we'd love to hear from you. We've set up an email address. You can contact us at willbaseballstories@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your stories. And if you have some pictures to send along, that would be graciously appreciated. We'll be compiling those into a website we'll be putting up soon. Also, the reminder that some of this Buckley Dutch Masters footage will be part of a short program on WILL-TV. We'll air Ken Burns' follow-up to baseball 10th inning. That'll air September 27th and 28th. You'll see short segments on the Buckley Dutch Masters as well as the Danville Dans those two evenings in September. I want to thank you both for coming in. We've been talking about the Eastern Illinois League. Our guests have been Fred Croner from the News Gazette. His book is Catching Up, the Official History of the Eastern Illinois Baseball League. It's published by the News Gazette. Fred, much appreciated.
Thanks for having me here. And if people are interested in buying the book, they can contact me or drop by the News Gazette. There's plenty of copies available.
And Darren Fletcher, a former big league catcher and former player with the Royal Giants, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.